Our bland faith in democracy as a political cure-all has propagated a cluster of illusions and delusions, some of which have caused us no little trouble and a great deal of expense. We take it for granted that all people should have our brand of democracy, whether or not they want it, and whether or not they are equipped to make it work. We even take it for granted that a democratic form of government can be imposed from without. And we take it for granted that a democracy can be made to work in any latitude. As Senator Pettigrew observed near the end of the 19th century, it's awfully difficult to make a banana and self-government grow on the same piece of land. While this is an exaggeration, it does underscore a profound truth. Woodrow Wilson, in the midst of his very earnest efforts to bar bloody-handed dictatorship from the presidency of Mexico, made the statement, quote, "I'm going to teach the South American republics to elect good men," end of quote. Wilson was a great professor. Walter Hines Page echoed much the same sentiment when he wrote about shooting men into self-government. All of these conflicting strands in the web of public opinion must be taken into account by any president or any secretary of state. A paradox develops. For while it may be contrary to fact to describe the United States as a selfless nation, concerned primarily with the welfare of other people, nevertheless, public opinion in this country does tend to judge foreign policy, not merely from the point of view of whether it serves the interests of the United States as stated, but also whether it shows due consideration for other countries. This duality in public opinion bewilders the non-American observer, who finds it difficult to reconcile the idealism and the desire of Americans, as voiced in our press and on our lecture platforms, with the hard-headed determination to have the United States make as few concessions as possible to other states. The American people and their political leaders have a tendency to want their cake and eat it too. Prejudice, a sense of mission then, is one of the factors which affects American thinking with respect to foreign policy. We are also a moody people in the field of policy. In the period before World War II, the dominant and overt foreign policy was a composite of withdrawal impulses, cynicism about power politics, intolerance of other peoples and cultures, pessimism about the prospects of idealistic internationalism. Many experiences had combined to produce this state of mind, but it was a state of public mind. The growing threat to American security began to undermine this withdrawal mood. It began in the late 30s. But it took Pearl Harbor to produce a broad interventionist consensus. American intolerance of foreign countries and social systems was supplanted by a tolerance of actual and potential allies. Cynicism and pessimism about power politics gave way to certain idealistic aspirations and optimistic expectations of peace and international order to be achieved through international organizations. This mood prevailed throughout the latter part of the war and the brief period of Allied amity following the close of hostilities. As specific conflicts with the Soviet Union broadened into general controversy with the Soviets, which we characterize as the Cold War, the foreign policy mood changed again. Idealistic internationalism faded before security realism. Now, there is some value in recognizing that an overtly interventionist and responsible United States hides isolationist longing, that an overtly tolerant America is at the same time barely stifling intolerance, that an idealistic America is muttering sotto voce cynicism, while a surface optimism conceals the dread of the future. One must always take into account the fact that Americans in this period of their development are both responsible and irresponsible. A momentary rift in the clouds brings the irresponsible trends to the surface, An intensification of threat brings out a sober readiness to sacrifice. The foreign policy mood is fluctuating, and it changes in very wide sweep. This is evidenced by an analysis of succeeding public opinion polls on the importance of foreign relations. Over the years, there were a long list of polls taken in which the pollsters asked the persons interviewed to indicate whether or not foreign policy was more important than domestic issues at that particular moment. To look at the answers to those polls is significant. In November 1935, 11% thought foreign policy was more important than domestic affairs. By December 36, it was 26%. But in January 39, it was down to 14%. In December 39, it was up to 47%. In August of 40, it was 48%. In November of 41, it was 81%. And so on. Now you can say, well, the war is approaching, and of course foreign politics become more important in that kind of climate. But that hardly answers when you realize that in October 45, only 7% thought foreign policy most important. But by July 47, by March 47, it reached 54%. And during 47, it ranged from 54 to 47 to 28 to 30. Or in 1948, it ranged from 33 to 73 to 50 to 34. The pressure of the events don't move that fast, but the mood changes rapidly, and it changes largely as a result of particular speeches made by key individuals in a nationwide hookup. Now, the lack of real involvement on the part of the individual in world politics is suggested by the limited character of his information about international affairs. After all, when you get the average American really interested in a problem, he shows an amazing amount of erudition and a great ability to analyze. Witness the experts on the standing of the baseball clubs in the major leagues. Any American can give you the scores of games decade ago and tell you who's going to win the pennant next year in a major league. That is evidence of interest when stimulated. But the fact that the American is not interested in foreign policy is indicated by his lack of interest in foreign policy. Or, let me put it this way, his knowledge about foreign policy is a good barometer of his interest. When the average American is keenly interested, he knows, or he seeks to learn. When he isn't, he doesn't. The fact that the average American fails to bring the same learning and skill that he uses with regard to baseball to foreign affairs may be an index of his lack of interest. The Cincinnati study of 1947 indicated that 30% of the adult population, 30%, was unfamiliar with the purpose of the United Nations organization. 55 out of the remaining 70% were so misinformed as to believe that the United Nations, among its functions, had the job of making peace with Japan and Germany. The election in 1948 so discredited the use of public opinion polls, I hesitate to use them here, but let me point out that they were only discredited when used as for the purpose of making election predictions. The polls are not nearly as unreliable as the public believes, and so much by way of justifying my use here. One quite valid use of public opinion polls is to disclose the areas of ignorance in the population. Those who analyze and interpret polls classify people in three categories. First, the unaware. These are people who freely confess that they have neither heard nor read of important issues in American foreign policy. Then there is the aware. These are people who have heard or read the issues, but who have but a rudimentary knowledge concerning them. They still are not informed persons. They have read something of it or heard something of policy. And then there are the informed, the people who are not only aware of the issues, but who know the meaning and the implications of them. Now, the unaware and the aware group constitute the total of the uninformed. Using these definitions, public opinion analysts over a period of years have established the following conclusions. About 30% of the electorate, on the average, is unaware of almost any given event in American foreign policy. About 45% of the electorate is aware. These people retain little information. Although they may follow the discussions of the issues of foreign policy, they cannot frame intelligent arguments concerning those issues. This leaves 25% of the electorate consistently showing a knowledge of foreign affairs. Now, it must be noted that these generalizations will not hold for any particular issue at any particular time. When an aspect of foreign policy is the big news of the moment, the number of the unaware group is likely to drop somewhat, and the number of the aware but uninformed group, as well as the number of the informed group, will increase. Now, who are the informed in the American electorate? Of 45 million women eligible to vote, some 38 million are uninformed about the most important issues and events of American foreign policy. Almost 10 million never heard or read of them. The lower income a person has, the less is his information about foreign relations. 88% of voters of less than average income, compared to 82% with more than average income, could not tell you the purpose of the Marshall Plan. About 29% of Americans with grammar school education are wholly unaware of foreign policy issues, compared with 3% college graduates. The uneducated are, by and large, the same persons who fall into the low-income group. Urban residents are generally better informed than people in rural areas. It may be that educational facilities are better in the cities, that the cities prosper on commerce, which is a branch of foreign affairs. But whatever the reason, the facts are easily seen in the polls. Persons living on the East and West Coast are better informed than those in the Middle West and those in the Southern Hinterland or the Southwest. In general, the number of those informed on questions of foreign policy is no greater than the number of those who are totally unaware of foreign policy issues. Now, the above data is based on public opinion polls, but it must be noted that one weakness of the polls is that they tend to overestimate the voter's store of information rather than underestimate it. So the picture's even worse than the statistics given. But even when an issue has received widespread publicity, a large proportion of the electorate remains wholly unaware of it, and substantially less than half will be found to be informed. This holds true for any foreign policy. While the polls indicate that the degree of awareness is about the same for domestic and foreign policies, fewer persons are found in the informed group on foreign affairs than you will find in the informed group on domestic affairs. George Gallup estimates that the difference is the difference between one-fourth and one-third. One-third of your population is informed with respect to domestic questions, one-fourth with respect to foreign policy questions. Martin Kreisberg made an analysis of the polls with respect to the Marshall Plan, and it's interesting to take this as a key sample. The informed group under the Kreisberg pattern gave reasonably accurate statements of the purpose of the Marshall Plan. The aware group, which he labeled A, thought the Marshall Plan meant just help Europe and knew nothing more about it than that. The aware group B did not know what its purpose was. They'd heard of it, but they didn't have any idea with respect to its purpose. The unaware had never heard or read anything about the Marshall Plan. Now let's look at the pattern of it. This group of black lines here constitute the informed. These could give you some estimate of what the Marshall Plan meant. These are the aware group, the aware A, and the aware B. And these are the wholly uninformed. From it, certain generalizations can be made.